Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. June 18th, 2009, going right into the show tonight. Quite a few news items to talk about, but first I want to announce the main science topic, and that deals with something we all take for granted, I think, too many times, as we live on this relatively calm environment in the very inner solar system around an average star, our water and atmosphere. Something we very much take for granted. But where do these come from? And there again, every week I announce on this show, I have been, it's the Tier 2 Bad Science topic of the week, or I like to bring these up to show how much just absolutely terrible science is out there that is being promoted to the public. And, of course, relative to the atmosphere and our oceans, scientists in standard science cannot tell you where either came from, how they got on Earth, or how our atmosphere got to the point it's at right now, but they will all assure you that it has been exactly the same for the last 4.5 billion years since the Earth was allegedly formed at that time, according to standard science. And all of that is just wild speculation as far as real scientific method is concerned. But where did the Earth's water and atmosphere come from? Why do some large bodies on Earth have salt in them? Some large bodies of inland seas have so much salt that nothing will even grow in it. Some are extremely salty, while other big lakes, like the Great Lakes in the North American continent, have absolutely no salt at all. Very interesting, but that's not the topic. The main science topic is trying to piece together, according to a realistic model of the solar system, where on Earth did the water come from and our atmosphere, and what's the real history? And when you understand what the true history is, you'll understand also that standard science, once again, is expecting the public to believe completely bogus concepts. And the one thing I like to point out is when you study science of, say, geology or the history of the Earth, planet science, planetary science, what you realize is there are so many ridiculously bad and improbable theories out there in standard science that you, first of all, can't even begin to list them all. But when you come right down to the bottom line, they cannot tell you where these things came from. Mountain building doesn't make any sense according to standard science. The plate tectonics, we see plates moving around the Earth, but is that really due to this slow process that the Earth does this all by itself? Or is the Earth relaxing from major extra solar system objects coming into the solar system and ravaging Earth, the other planets, and causing the Earth basically great upheavals that create the mountain systems and wrench the Earth's surface so that it continues to move and adjust, etc. But the one of the biggest flaws in standard science is where did the Earth's water and oceans, water, oceans, and atmosphere come from? And why are they so different and varying around the world if they were all created at the same time, so to speak? So anyway, that's the main science topic, and it's something that affects us every day. And, of course, if you've read my books, you will understand what the true source of these are. But I'm going to go into a little bit of depth on the history of the Earth. What were the changes that took place at various times? How did the Earth react? What was the, did we ever have periods where there was more water than there is today, or less water, or more atmosphere and less atmosphere? And what is the true history of Earth? And how badly is standard science really missing the boat here? On to the first just general topics here. This past week, 2 days ago, it was announced that a boy died in Florida of the swine flu. And, of course, to date in the United States, there have been 45 what they call confirmed cases of death due to the swine flu. But I've been following this, and in every case, there were complications that the patient had that caused them to die. And this is the case with any influenza or any kind of cold or flu. A lot of people die of the common cold, supposedly, every year. In fact, the number of people dying from the common cold this year probably far outweighs people dying from influenza. But the young 9-year-old in Florida, this was the alleged first case of death in Florida, in the state of Florida. But the problem was that the young man had complications, asthma, and other respiratory complications that he had before getting the flu. So did he die from the flu, or did he die from complications that arose that he could have gotten from many other causes? But the point is that the reporting on the swine flu, and this carries across on just about every topic we see in the Western press, is skewed. It is straining at the bit to try and promote a story that really is not true. And then in the article that I read, that I believe it came from one of the Florida newspapers, it was very clear that at the end, the very last statement is, most cases are mild and require no treatment. And they're talking about the swine flu being in 74 countries. Thus, the declaration last week, actually Thursday, my last show, it was the World Health Organization declared a pandemic. And one of the statements in the article that I read said, the declaration of a pandemic pushes drug makers to fast-track production of swine flu vaccine. Well, I think we know what's going on here. There's a lot of money to be made, and it goes back to the pharmaceutical companies. So, unfortunately, the push to exaggerate this disease. They say there are 27,000 cases worldwide, half of those being in the United States. And it's like a lot of data collection. When you have more data collection in a given area, then you might see more higher numbers. And let's take earthquakes, for example. As earthquake reporting became more sophisticated and we have remote sensors all over the world, then the number of earthquakes reported increased. It's not that we're having more earthquakes, it's just that the reporting is there. There's more ability to gather data. So what does that tell you? And then it appears that since there's a big push in the United States, and of course that's where the pharmaceutical companies are located, the big push is to exaggerate the swine flu. And actually, if you look at an average flu season, 27,000 people getting the flu is a minuscule number relative to the average flu strains. So why is this one receiving such attention? It begs the question, but obviously bad news reporting in the public is subject to this, and obviously many of the topics we see coming up today in the world deal with very skewed reporting. Here's an article that I pulled off of actually one of the Institute of Physics pages sent to me by a fan, and it deals with the Earth's magnetic field. Earth's magnetic field protects us from the solar wind. It's very important to Earth. And I talk about this, of course, in my weather book. I talk about it in the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. So the magnetic field of Earth has some very interesting properties. We have a permanent magnetic field in Earth, which is relatively small. But then we have a plasma or some other source of magnetic field. And I was the first one ever to put together a composite model, a structured layered model of the entire magnetic field of Earth. And at this point, standard science is trying to copy that. But the thing that I did is I related it to the electrical fields in outer space. And of course, standard science cannot talk about such things as electric fields. So they have to find some imaginary, ridiculous source for the Earth's magnetic field. The traditional standard science explanation for Earth's magnetic field came about 50 years ago when scientists said, oh, well, the Earth has this molten core which is flowing around, and that must cause the currents, electrical currents, to flow, and therefore that's the cause of Earth's magnetic field. Well, it all comes down to a very simple thing called energy. To keep Earth's magnetic field stable and in existence for millions and billions of years, you need a source of energy. Magnetic fields just don't self-exist in any form, whether it's in a planet or in a plasma environment of outer space. They simply don't exist on their own. And if one formed, it would need a constant source of energy to support it, because other opposing magnetic fields would and other plasma effects would come in to neutralize it. So you need an ongoing source of energy to support these magnetic fields. But anyway, this particular article says that a new paper in a peer-reviewed journal was published in the New Journal of Physics, partly owned by Institute of Physics, IP, and the German Physical Society. Now, the old standard explanation for Earth's magnetic field simply lacks any credibility because it doesn't give a source of energy to maintain those electrical currents that are supposedly running around in Earth's interior. But you'll find every textbook that mentions the subject filled with those types of explanations. So now the new article, which supposedly is controversial, says that Earth's oceans are the cause of our magnetic field, and that the ocean currents, the water flowing around in ocean currents, in fact, is what causes the Earth's geomagnetic field. But once again, this is a ridiculous idea. Just simply go back to the energy argument. It's the same one that you can use to show why hurricanes could not possibly form from warm water. Because the energy, amount of energy is simply not there. And secondly, there's no mechanism to get the heat from the ocean into a thrashing hurricane above the ocean. It's physically impossible. It violates the second law of thermodynamics, which states you can't take energy out of a lesser energetic system and put it into a more energetic system. Astrophysics and space science and astronomy are filled with ridiculous concepts. For example, the solar corona, where you have relativistic electrons circling the sun. And scientists are trying to show how small, minute explosions in the solar atmosphere are driving this with energies that are far less than the corona. It's, once again, bad science trying to take previously held bad science and extend it out to new observations. So anyway, the idea that somehow the Earth's oceans drive our magnetic field, more bad Tier 2 science, trying to replace old bad Tier 2 science. A week ago, I examined an article on the show dealing with typhoons And I've been saying for years that typhoons and hurricanes, when they make landfall, can trigger earthquakes. Well, a new so-called study came out and did some statistical analysis, basically proving what I was saying, but then had to supply the tier two argument that it was the atmospheric pressure, the lower atmospheric pressure of the hurricane or typhoon that caused the earthquake. But there again, they gave no process, no physical process or energy calculation or, you know, empirical method, whatever. There was no way to associate the loss of atmospheric pressure and an earthquake, which is taking place 5 miles underground. So how can they publish these articles making some type of alleged correlation and not have the main piece in there? How does this happen? This is in a physics journal. Wouldn't you expect some physics? Excuse me, I'm just choking over this. This is such bad physics. But the reason every week I pick one of these articles and highlight it on my show is because this is the garbage science that they're trying to throw out and at the public. And of course, there's no way that any of this can happen. The electric or magnetic conditions around Earth, the magnetic fields of Earth, etc., the various layers of magnetic field, without a power source. And that power source, the only one available is the sun and the non-uniform distribution of charged particles in the solar wind. So, at any rate, that's kind of a long-winded explanation, but as I said, I try and fill the public in every week so that you understand the damage that tier two science is doing. And this is the garbage science that they keep putting out to the public. It's bad science based on bad science based on more bad science. But it permeates everything that you see in the newspapers, on and on. Just a little update on Air France. There has been literally no new news reporting in the past week or so. But basically, now they're attempting to say that because none of the recovered bodies had burn marks on them, that there could not have been an explosion. And, of course, now the news media is promoting this. Now, since the investigators, as far as their own claims in the news, were not even looking at the possibility of an explanation or the possibility of an explosion, why is the news media jumping in and trying to preempt any idea of an explosion with, once again, news reporting? And this is why I became involved in the Air France Flight 447 issue, is because obviously, right out of the gate, CNN and other international news agencies put out bogus news reports that were not based on any possible reality at all and kept pushing and pushing these. And now it's becoming more clear that there was a concerted effort behind the scenes to promote incorrect news reporting by the major news reporting agencies around the world, to the point where the CEO of Air France had to come out, go public, and state that all that was being reported in the news media was not to be believed. And he said he made some statements, but the news media continues to try and push the idea that there was bad weather. There was not any bad weather relative to this air disaster. What else? The other thing is clear is this plane kept flying after it initially started to break apart. And it flew for quite a long distance, and it has to be clear that the plane turned around under less than perfect flying conditions, in that the plane was partly missing, possibly an engine, possibly a tail section, and the passenger area of the plane had been breached. In other words, chairs and seats and passengers were flying out of the airplane as it continued to fly and then retry and return back to Brazil. So why now is the press trying to force the idea that there was no explosion when two other pilots saw explosion from that region and saw parts burning as they fell to the ocean? This all smacks of a cover-up of vast proportions, that there was an explosion, that there was a sabotage of that airplane. And why is this not being reported? Why is it not being analyzed? And why is the news media trying to use very scant data to try and state that there was no explosion relative to this airplane? Now, at any rate, that's all I'm going to say about that. I'm not going to spend more time in this show other than the news reporting is clearly making every effort to give false and slanted information on Flight 447. On to the next topic. Just a quick note. $1 trillion for health care in the United States. Congress now looking at the possibility of spending $1 trillion on health care and to reduce the number of uninsured people by 16 million by the year 2015. Well, that's 6 years away. Obviously, the United States healthcare system is a disaster. If you want to see a model healthcare, dental care, education system, look to Cuba. And you have to understand that we cannot continue in this country throwing vast amounts of money at an industry where this money is going to be soaked up by the pharmaceutical and AMA, the pharmaceutical companies. This will be a direct infusion of $1 trillion to the pharmaceutical companies and the established medical community in the United States. And that's all it is. That's where it's coming from. That's where the lobbying is taking place. And that's why Congress will pass it, because they are bought and paid for no good, worthless politicians who do the bidding of large corporations and large industries in this country. But as I said, if they're really interested in health care reform, they would take the model of other countries who have successful health care. The life expectancy in Cuba, the education literacy rate in Cuba, all of these far exceed anything found in the United States. The dental program there, everybody has access to good dental treatment. And why is that? Why is a country that is laughed at in the U.S. press actually has a much better, and it's a model for all Latin America. Latin America sends their brightest students to Cuba to learn dentistry, medicine. That's where they simply go. They go there to learn how to bring this into basically what used to be a third world country. So the question is, why is a country that's supposedly the most powerful, richest country in the world, we have a very poor rate, we have a low rate of literacy compared to Cuba? The longevity of people in this country is much lower than Cuba, and dental care in this country is terrible for the majority of people. Most dental programs in this country, and I noticed too that this healthcare $1 trillion does nothing towards dental. Now, if you want healthy people, they have to have healthy teeth and gums. And this is simply not the case, and it never will be in the United States. Dental insurance coverage in the United States is gotten to the point where it is almost non-existent. So, at any rate, $1 trillion being spent over a 6-year period, which will not solve the problem. for the majority of people. It will simply stick money into the pockets of already wealthy organizations and industries. Niagara Falls, this was interesting. Somebody sent me a picture, and I don't know where all this came from. Sometimes you get things that are emails, and somebody emailed, and it's hard to find the original source. But there's a picture of Niagara Falls completely frozen in the year 1911. There were many years, not many years, but occasional years when Lake Superior would freeze over all the way across. And you could actually walk across Lake Superior in the middle of the winter. I'm not sure if I would actually want to do that, but there are islands out in Lake Superior that have animals on them, and that's how the animals got there, during years when it was completely frozen, and they could walk out there. But at any rate, very interesting to see these pictures of Niagara Falls in the year 1911, completely frozen. So the water is coming over the waterfalls, but it's just a big icicle. Very interesting photos. But it just shows that our climate is variable. And the climatologists, just to clarify what's happened with the idea of global warming. Remember, first, it was the greenhouse effect. Greenhouse effect migrated into global warming because scientists realized that the greenhouse effect didn't work. It simply does not work. It doesn't work on Venus, where there is a ton of carbon dioxide, and it shouldn't even work at all on Earth. But as long as people keep repeating it, then they think it's true. The actual, it was a great cover story in all the tree huggers, which I like. I got a lot of friends. I'm kind of a tree hugger myself. But I realized that the global warming issue was a great cover story to prevent people, to keep them looking over here while the real issue of pollution was completely untouched. And politicians could say, oh, I voted for this thing, and by the year 2020, we're going to reduce carbon emission by 5%. Ridiculous statements that have no bearing, that don't do anything, absolutely ridiculous. But people would, and then people would go around and have concerts. Al Gore got a Nobel Prize. But now, they're talking about not global warming, but climate change. Climate change at first meant the same thing as global warming. But now that things are cooling down, people are just kind of migrating. This is what I call the creeping crud. Bad science, more bad science, more bad science being thrown at the public. But the creeping crud now has global warming changing into climate change. Now climate change can mean it's getting cooler. All by the same people that originally started mouthpiecing the greenhouse effect 20 years ago or 30 years ago, however. I think it was about 30 years ago. And of course, then the politically correct groups picked that up. And it turns out that it's very simple. We depend on a minute-by-minute basis for our heat and for our climate, if you want to call it that, from the sun. If the sun turned off right now, it would take about 6 hours. You know, when we go around on the dark side, the night side of Earth, the temperature will drop anywhere from 5 to 20 degrees. And that's because the sun isn't hitting Earth. And then if you stayed in darkness, in other words, if the sun all of a sudden turned off, it would be a matter of a day or two, all the moisture would rain, would fall out of the sky, out of the atmosphere in terms of snow or ice or whatever, some kind of frozen water vapor. And then within probably a week to two, the entire atmosphere would freeze and fall to the ground as dry ice, carbon dioxide. Finally, the nitrogen would fall out. But at any rate, the point is that our climate is dependent on a minute-by-minute basis from energy from the sun and also from electrical energy that is constantly coming into Earth. That's coming from the solar, passing solar wind. All of those details are explained in my book. So at any rate, climate is something that is a very tenuous topic. But it's interesting to see the mileage that people get out of talking about these issues when literally we have no control over it at all. It can get cooler. And this actually brings us into the next topic. The poor crops that are emerging now in the upper Midwest due to the cold spring. We had a terrible winter this past winter. It started early. It just didn't end. And then when spring came, there was one hot 80-degree day about a month ago, and then the temperatures dropped down. But the farmers went out and planted prior to Memorial Day, which is standard practice, but corn, for example, needs temperatures above 70 degrees during its growing cycle. It can dip down a little bit at night, but you need those warm summer days above 70 degrees for corn to prosper. And this year, farmers planted, some of them a little bit early, and the crops are hurting because in that little, that early stage when the plant is just above the ground and it's a couple inches tall, it's very sensitive to temperatures. So a lot of farmers in the upper Midwest are going to see poor crop results this year, 2009, and it's already taken place. We had very dry weather in some places and overly wet weather in other places. So the weather was not cooperating with the plants. So there will be a lot of what you might call very poor harvests. I saw some fields that were just without rain, and the plants, you might as well just plow them under. But at any rate, once again, related to climate. Let me just talk quickly about the water filters. I haven't talked about them for a couple weeks. Of course, on my webpage or by mail order, you can order the Dalton water filters. There's the stainless steel, what I call the long-term solution, the one that you will give to your children's children's children if you live that long, or could be passed on, made out of stainless steel. And those are $319. They come with four Super Sterisil three-part Dalton filters. These are the filters that go to all of the countries in the world when there's a disaster. These have been everywhere. I know there are just an amazing amount of number of these in third world countries because of the need for fresh water. It's a simple solution. There's no hookups, there's no pipes or tubes or electricity. You just pour the water in the top, clean water comes out the bottom. And you can also add on an arsenic fluoride filter if you live and have city water, or if you live in the country, a lot of times there's arsenic in the water. But at any rate, $319, that includes shipping to the 50 states, and that includes the two stainless steel containers, four the Dalton ceramic filters. Two of them you use, or sometimes I just use one in mine, and then I got some spares. So it's basically sold, comes with two filters and two spares. And then, of course, the free Kato WRX 911 emergency radio is included for free. And you can listen to my show and a lot of other radio shows. It has an AM/FM band also. But all of the shortwave bands on this little emergency radio, and that comes free in the package with the Dalton water filter, $319. And the mail order address, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, M-N, 55392. Once again, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392, or go to the webpage, just seven letters, J-M-C-C, S is in science, C is in Charlie, I is in indigo.com, J-M-C-C-S-C-I.com. on to the main science topic, dealing with water and atmosphere. They're very interrelated because there's a lot of water in our atmosphere. There are literally rivers, vast rivers of water in our atmosphere flowing around the Earth every day. And this, of course, contributes to our weather systems. But where did this come from? Where did the water come from? Where did the atmosphere come from? Where did the minerals that are in the ocean, where did those come from? Why do some inland lakes have, or oceans, like the Dead Sea, the Red Sea, the Caspian Sea, why do they have salt in them as if they were once part of the ocean system? And why do some very large lakes, the Great Lakes of North America, Lake Superior, Michigan, Huron, Erie, the Great Lakes, Lake Michigan, why do they not have any salt in them? What is the deal here? What's the history of Earth? What is the true history of water? Where did these come from? And why are there lakes, freshwater lakes, 2 miles under the ice cap in Antarctica? What is going on here? Something very strange is going on. We have two polar caps of solid ice. We have the North Polar Cap, which literally floats in the ocean. There is no continent underneath it. And then we have Antarctica, which is a large continent that happens to be right smack dab in the middle of the South Polar region. That's the region, the point around which Earth spins, the spin axis pole of Earth, the North and the South Pole. And of course, the magnetic poles are off from those. They're very different from the spin axis poles, although they're trying to work their way back after a very jarring experience a number of thousands of years ago. But now let's go back to the beginning of Earth and let's look at the standard science explanation for how the planet formed and all the planets. They say that there were rocky meteorites that coalesced in a dust cloud and that eventually the planets formed. And there's this is called the Laplacian solar system formation model. It goes back to Laplace, who just kind of threw this out there. It wasn't really a well thought out model. But at any rate, the idea is that somehow all of this rocky material coalesced and formed a planet, and when it did, it was so hot, it was molten, and therefore the self-gravity allowed it to form a ball. Okay, well, that's swell, but it's a terrible theory. It could never work. It doesn't explain any of the properties of the planets. The biggest one being the spin axis. All the planets that are spinning spin in a, if you look from the north side, they spin in basically a counterclockwise direction. And the point being is that in a gravitational falling system like that, if you do the math, the planets would all spin backwards of what they spin today. So then they come in and say, oh, well, each one got hit just exactly right with an asteroid, and it made it spin the other way. Well, you know, the amount of garbage theories and band-aid theories you have to pile on top of this to even make it work in the most rudimentary sense is ridiculous. And then they say, well, where did the moon come from? Oh, well, another thing hit the Earth, and then the moon popped out. Well, you know, there's no verification for any of this. This is all wild speculation. And besides, there's no gouging area in the side of Earth that is the size of the moon that would indicate that that happened at all. So none of this makes any sense. But the crux of the issue, the crux of the issue is, then where did the atmosphere and the oceans come from? Well, then one idea is that, well, they just kind of emerged out of this rocky planet out of the ground. They just kind of popped out of the ground, and there they were. The venting of volcanoes, etc., would have belched some gases into the atmosphere. And there's where your oceans and water came from. Voila. Well, here's the problem. as allegedly every piece hit the Earth in this formative process, the heat would have been tremendous in that location, and any gases or water vapor would have steamed off at a very high temperature and simply escaped Earth at that point. And so there's no reason to believe also that these rocks coming in had any water in them at all. Then they go and they say, well, comets could have brought the water. Well, if you look at a comet, I mean, really look at it, if you look at the pictures that have come back from real comets, you find that they have absolutely no water on the nucleus at all. So the idea that comets brought water to Earth by smashing into Earth doesn't work either. So this is, once again, the bad Tier 2 science, the dirty snowball comet model, which, when you go look at a comet nucleus, these little ones, there's no water there. So what is really going on here? What is a comet? What's the real nature of comets? And the biggest question is, where did Earth get its atmosphere and oceans? So the true history of Earth is that sometime in the history of the solar system, after Jupiter and the Sun were relatively stable as a twin star system, and there could be, say, other large planets the size of Jupiter way out there. Just a second. Excuse me, I had to get a drink of water here. Filtered water from my Dalton water filter, by the way. I should mention this, too, about the Dalton water filters. If you do sprouting, you would want to use filtered water. The sprouts grow much better. And of course, it doesn't have all the pollutants that come in tap water or from well water. So if you are doing sprouting, and that's something you should be doing, then you should use filtered water. But anyway, back to the issue of water coming into planet Earth. Now, just the idea that water had to come in after the planet formed indicates that, excuse me, why wouldn't water come in at other stages after that? And of course, there's no reasonable explanation for that in standard science. They simply say that the water and atmosphere formed at one time. They don't know how. They really, if you really press scientists, they really cannot tell you where the water and atmosphere came from. They just do this kind of hand-waving argument, expect you to believe it, and then say, make a definitive statement that nothing has come into our planet from outside ever since in terms of atmosphere and water. And that is absolutely ridiculous. And so the history of Earth actually shows repeatedly that Earth's atmosphere and ocean properties changed. Now let's skip to Mars for just a second, because Mars seems to be an enigma. Mars does not have any oceans. It has very little atmosphere, and it's very clear that Mars has all the earmarks, all of the geological earmarks, of a water planet. Historically, the ancients tell us that Mars was, in fact, a water planet, a blue planet, and a large comet came by and pulled the atmosphere and the oceans off in a single night. So there is a case of a planet right next door to us that has a vast, that had an atmosphere and oceans, and they're gone. There's a planet that is now rebuilding its atmosphere. Modern satellite data at Mars has confirmed that in the past 10 years, the atmosphere of Mars has doubled in extent. And this was confirmed when they tried to send an aerobraking satellite in to the Martian atmosphere. And when they got there, the data that they were using was 10 years old from a previous satellite that had been there measuring the extent of the Martian atmosphere. When the newer satellite came in, using aerobraking technique, that's where they blow up a great big balloon and it drags in the atmosphere, slows the satellite down. and then the satellite would fall into an orbit around Mars, and then eventually fall to the planetary surface and become a reporting device on the surface of Mars. 10 years difference in time, the atmosphere of Mars doubled in size. Well, how does this happen? Mars is just like Earth, is just like Venus. They all are discharging the solar capacitor, drawing in atmosphere and water all the time. So Mars eventually will regain its atmosphere. It will regain its oceans, but it's going to take a very long time. So let's come back to Earth. Earth is just the same. In fact, all the planets are like this. They're all bringing in material from the solar system. Jupiter is doing it. Saturn is doing it. Uranus, Neptune are doing it. The other planets. Very far out, the Kuiper Belt objects are drawing in material at a very slow rate, building up icy surfaces on an otherwise round planet. And Earth is doing the very same thing. So let's imagine that some of the mass extinctions that occurred on Earth throughout its history, what happened? Were there times when, just like Mars, Earth completely lost its atmosphere and oceans? It's very possible, and there probably were some times when that happened. Were there times when there was tremendous flooding and chemical pollution due to Earth passing through a comet tail? And remember that comets, the crux of the issue here also, is that comets are not dirty snowballs. They are a discharge of the solar capacitor, and they are actually pulling material in from their environment. The long comet tail is actually being attracted in towards the nucleus. And this is a rather complicated topic explained in my books, but the point relative to Earth is that when large comets come by, they contribute or they can pull away. And it depends on the relative size of the comet nucleus. The last major event we had was within the past 10,000 years, when a comet that eventually became the planet Venus came through the solar system and had two close encounters with Earth. There was mountain building, there were shifts in the continents, some land that used to be below the ocean rose up and is now above the land, and vice versa. Some of the land that was dry land sunk down and became ocean bottom. So there, in fact, there's very clear history that this happened. And you look at the continental shelves, for example, that extend out around literally every island, every country in the world. There is a continental shelf, which indicates that the ocean level was about 600 feet less a number of thousands of years ago, at least 200 feet, probably closer to 600 feet. And so where did all this water come from? It also indicates that the poles shifted. The old North Pole used to be in the middle of the Canadian province of Ontario, just north of the state of Michigan. And the old South Pole used to be in the South Indian Ocean, near an island called McDonald Island. Antarctica, the continent that we now see as the South Pole, used to be in a more temperate climate. So all of these changes are occurring while there's a great addition of water coming into the atmosphere. Now, I've talked about this before. I know my books talk about it, that the difference in the salt content of the Great Lakes of the North American continent versus many of the other salt lakes around the world. There's a basin in southwestern United States called the Great Salt Lake Basin, which used to be a great salt lake. And as the water evaporated away, the water became far more salty. The salt content of the water went up. And that's the same way with the Dead Sea. It's an area where it was landlocked. It had a certain salt content. And as the water evaporated away, the salt content became higher and higher. But how did the Great Lakes avoid becoming salt bodies like the other major inland seas of the world? And it turns out that they were under the old ice cap. In other words, the what we call the Laurentian ice shield was literally the old North Polar cap, and that sat above those lakes for who knows how long. So when that melted relatively quickly, after the Earth adjusted its spin axis and rotation, and once again, I show how that is accomplished in the supplement to the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. There are complete drawings in the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet, and it shows how that happens from a physics point of view. And so here's the difference between what I present and standard science. Standard science has a lot of hand-waving, gee-whiz articles or theories that really, when they go back to the original science, simply there's no real physics involved. It's just like the article I read dealing with the allegedly, the oceans causing the Earth's magnetic field. Well, that's fine. Somebody made a statistical study and found that some changes in ocean currents were related to changes in Earth's magnetic field. But where's the physics? Where's the physical process that tells you how this happens? And it's more like it's the other way around. The Earth's magnetic field is affecting the ocean currents, not vice versa. It seems like every time standard science wants to put out a new theory, it's backwards. The problem is they don't have to come up with a physical process. They published that article in a peer-reviewed physics journal. They published it without requiring the authors to come up with a physical process with energy calculations and everything else that you would need to have a bona fide theory. And of course, if they tried to come up with this, they wouldn't be able to, because there is no source of energy in the ocean currents to provide long-term stability for Earth's magnetic field. It's just that simple. It's the same problem that they had with the precursor theory, that somehow there's an internal dynamo in Earth's interior where all these electrical currents are flowing and create the magnetic field. Well, for current to flow, you need a battery. Where's the battery? How can it last for billions of years? And what's the source of this battery in Earth? Well, they've never identified it. More bad science replacing more bad science. And that's the point. When you get into the history of the Earth, the history of the Moon, and you go way back, and that includes the Earth's water source, where did it come from, and atmosphere, it's very clear that Earth has had epochs where it had more water and where it had less water. There were epochs when it had a much larger atmosphere and a much smaller atmosphere, and these correlated, the changes between these epochs correlates with mass extinctions, and this happened when large comets would come through the solar system and basically ravage Earth. And of course we see Mars as a great example sitting right next to us. There is evidence that during the dinosaur ages, the Earth's atmosphere was very dense. It was very thick, probably much more extensive than it is now, and probably had a very large haze layer of water in it. And probably what it would have looked like was a gigantic greenhouse. The poles probably had no ice at all. It was probably a fairly consistent weather system around the Earth at all times. There probably were no severe storms like we see today, because the Earth's atmosphere was far thicker, far denser, and the reason we have the storms we see today is because the ionosphere, which drives these storms, is relatively close to the surface of the Earth. If you had an atmosphere, say, 10 or 20 times heavier, more dense than it is now, it would be very difficult for that electrical energy to get all the way down to Earth and cause tornadoes, hurricanes, etc. So you would have a very even climate around Earth. And this persisted for about 180 million years. So that was the time period between major events in the solar system. The concept that we had such an event just within the last 10,000 years, probably around 3,500 years to 4,000 years ago on Earth, with a major comet coming in the solar system doing major damage, this is a very rare event. But clearly, it devastated the human population, and we are just beginning to grow out of it. All of the civilizations you see when the great explorers went out and started exploring the world in ships that left, what we call the New World, all of those civilizations were remnants of what had been there thousands of years earlier. And, of course, they had become evolved and evolved as they maintained their livelihood, and somehow the survivors eked out a living. And all of the legends of all of the countries, this is what the great work that Velikovsky did, was identifying all of the legends from all of the different countries that point back to the very same event when Venus, the comet, came through the solar system, and there were very major changes to Earth at that time. It wasn't the only time this happened in Earth's history. It was just the most recent time, and of course the one that affected man the most. These events happen somewhat on a regular scale. But the period, as I said, between major events when the dinosaurs were here was possibly 180 million years. So we don't have a good historical record of how often these objects come. There's a lot of chatter about Nibiru, and it's on a 3,600-year orbit, but we have a history that goes back that far, and Nibiru was not part of it. So if it were on a 3,600-year orbit, it would already have been here and left already. So there is some speculation that Halebop could have been Nibiru. But the orbits of these objects can change, so it's hard to say if, say, on its way out of the solar system last time, Nibiru had an encounter with Jupiter and put it in a larger orbit, for example. Maybe it won't come back for another 10,000 years. All the people running around the internet, jumping up and down, talking about Planet X, don't know physics, they don't know astronomy. They're just making wild speculations, and somebody, like a lot of other things, somebody says something, somebody repeats it, 10 other people repeat that, and then all of a sudden people start to think, oh, well, Nibiru has a 3,600-year orbit. And that, there's no basis for that. The thing that happened back then was that Venus came by. So there's a lot of confusion over Nibiru versus Venus the comet. And Venus became a planet, so it's not going to come back as a large comet again, if you see what I mean. So there's a lot of speculation by people with no basis for talking about it, and there definitely was something, the wormwood in the Old Testament, but trying to interpret that, and was it Venus, or was it literally a planet that came back and the ancients knew about this? There's no way of really understanding that, but at any rate, Earth has had many changes relative to its atmosphere and ocean during its history, and that was the main point of this talk tonight, my main science topic. And once again, I am just about out of time, so remember, read my books, look at the videos and DVDs. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.